Hello and welcome to the Gadget Show podcast. This week, we've got the one and only John Bentley joining us.
Hooray. We're chatting the rise and the very rapid fall of 3D TV. Remember that?
Oh, my goodness.
It was meant to be the future of television. You loved it. I remember this. With a full industry push, millions of sets sold, and then almost overnight, it just vanished. So what went wrong?
But before we get into that, a huge thank you to our sponsors, CEX. You know that feeling you get when you need the latest upgrade? Yeah? It turns out to be mostly marketing.
Meanwhile, your old phone, tablet, console or whatever is sitting there doing absolutely nothing. It still works. It's still worth money.
That's where CEX come in. Instead of letting it gather dust, you can trade it in for cash or, of course, use it to offset something you actually want.
Yeah, and the flip side is just as good. Everything's been properly tested and it's ready to go again.
Yeah, so you're not stuck in that endless cycle of new equals better.
And with a 5-year warranty, you're arguably getting more peace of mind than buying fresh.
Yeah, smart tech buying, less waste, less spend.
Check out webuy.com or head to CEX and see what your old kit's actually worth. First up, if you're enjoying the Gadget Show podcast, do us a favour. Hit follow, subscribe, leave us a rating, all that good stuff on your podcast app of choice. It genuinely helps more people find the show, keeps us doing what we're doing, and it means you'll get new episodes whenever they drop.
We love it. But first of all, John, welcome. Great
Hello.
To see
nice
you.
Nice to be here. Yes.
Haven't seen you since our Christmas special. So I guess, what have you been up to and what tech has captured your attention recently?
Ooh, yes. I mean, what have I been up to? I mean, lots of this and that, really. I mean, I opened a new exhibition at the National Motor Museum. I enjoyed that. That was a nice day out with Lord Montague. And it's a bit double-edged for me, actually, going to car museums. I love them, but increasingly, I find that I can remember driving the exhibits when they were new.
So give us an example. What sort of things are at this new exhibition?
I mean, I think it's all these things that I mean, there's a lot of sort of spectacular stuff. But I mean, for me, it's supposed to be an exhibition about how cars have affected people's lives. And you actually, you get lots of memories come back with all the cars there. I can remember there was a Triumph TR2 there. I can remember one of our neighbours had one. They used to take me out in it, and I was able to sort of have my first driving experiences in that when I was about 12 or 13.
How great. And that's probably what got you hooked on cars.
Oh, no, I was hooked on cars for as long as I can remember. I think I was born hooked on cars.
Oh, right. So perhaps you were born in a car.
No.
Shall we move on to gadgets?
Well, we could do it if you like. Yes. Your thing's all retro, isn't it? I mean, a lot of your episodes, I mean, you're talking about your cassettes.
Yeah. I know.
And Jason with all his games consoles made out of Lego for some reason, which I don't understand. But
and me and my vinyl. I mean, we're very, very stuck.
We're loving
in
the retro. Yeah. What have you got? Have you got a retro device for
you
us?
You can talk anyway.
Yes. Well, I thought I'd bring them along. Yes. I've got a couple of sort of retro inspired cameras, really. They are. One is the Camp Snap 8, which you're familiar with the Camp Snap stills camera, which was a digital camera that aimed to emulate sort of a disposable camera. And it's a digital camera without a screen. It's called the Camp Snap, the idea that kids could take it to holiday camps in the summer and not be distracted by smartphones. Well, they've now done a video version. They call it Camp Snap 8, which sort of inspired by old 8mm film cameras from the 60s, with this sort of pistol grip at the front.
Gorgeous.
And things like this. I mean, they've interpreted it in a very interesting way, I think. I mean, it's got lots of knobs and switches, things on-off switch there. That's, you can change your aspect ratio, square, 16x9, 9x16. When you want to go vertical or horizontal, 4x3, all that sort of thing. You get some visual effects you can put on here, black and white, and one or two sort of filmy effects. They've got meters on the side for the battery and how much storage you've got left.
It comes a
meter for storage. No sort of crude digital thing. It actually is a little needle, and because some of those old those 8mm film cameras back in the 60s had those sort of things for aperture and how many minutes.
Honestly, that film, when you look back at that footage, it's just fantastic, isn't it? You're sort of slightly speeded up, aren't you, kind of, when you play it, for some reason everything's like a little bit faster than it should be, so you're running down the beach at 100 miles an hour, your little legs going, and you're 4 years old.
It's a bit desaturated, isn't it? And often you get like light bleed onto it.
Yeah, but I love that.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's so atmospheric. I mean, obviously it's retro, and if you're from a certain era, you know, all your kids' stuff, all your stuff growing up and
can
everything.
I see it, John? Mm.
is on that kind of footage, and that is, that's a good take on it, isn't
it's
it? Good,
it's got it's audio as well in this case, which is, I mean, you could get some of those Super 8 cameras with audio, but they're very rare. I mean, all these things, they're deliberately lo-fi, really, isn't it? I mean, you obviously will get far better results on your phone, but... it's our love of lo-fi, our love of the imperfect, and it's sort of, it's only a digital zoom. You don't get any optical.
Oh, so that's a slight negative in a way, I suppose. Yes. It's a digital zoom, but it kind of goes with it as
I
well.
Think sometimes so with these products, I mean, we're talking niche, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And so, you know, to make it affordable, so they can actually do it, it makes a bit of sense if you've got to. You know, give away your actual physical zoom to make something that's affordable. Because, I mean, how much
how much is it, actually? Because you've got a really great find here. We love this.
It's about 150 quid,
I think. So it's doable for a normal budget. Because I know some of these things can be very expensive. Relatively well made. I mean, it's got a kind of fake Bakelite feel to it, hasn't it? Mm.
And you can't play anything back on the screen, so you've got to wait until you get home to find out what.
I quite like that,
recorded.
Though. That takes me back a bit, you know, where everything's not instant.
Love it. Absolutely beautiful. So
but that's not the only one of these about. The other one here, I've got the Instax Mini Evo Cinema, which is yet another take on the... On Fuji's sort of Instax brand, which is it's an amazing company in some ways because they do these amazingly high-end cameras. They also do these very lo-fi Instax cameras as well, which are traditionally obviously have been with the instant photograph, the Polaroid-ish type thing. Mm-hmm. And this does do that, but it does other things as well. It works as a printer, like their LiPlay printer, so you can print out things from your phone. It's also a video camera. And it's a video camera with lots of effects. You can basically choose your decade, and it'll put sort of effects on your video. So if you did the 1930s, it'd be all in sort of black and white and with flickering frames. If you go for 1950s, it gives you a sort of simulated TV picture.
Can you see it in the viewfinder?
It's got a screen. It's also got a viewfinder attachment, I think, which goes onto the. If you want to use it more in a pistol grip way, and to print out, you've got a little turny thing there.
Oh, nice!
So you've got all these weird things. You can choose your borders as well around it. There you can switch borders on. It gives you a sort of, so for the 80s, you get a sort of digital imprint of the date on, for example.
Right. Yeah.
It's also digital zoom. Digital zoom operated by that lever there. And you can also print out bits from your video clips, which are only maximum length 30 seconds, I think. And you can you put a QR code onto a printed still, and it will refer you to the video,
online.
Online on Fuji's website. So, what are they going to do with all these
weddings?
These video
It'll weddings, be a wedding thing, wouldn't it? That you could go around the tables,
yeah,
couldn't
absolutely,
you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so, I suppose so. Yeah, sure.
So it's sort of an amazingly diverse thing.
And in terms of the printing, have you had a play? What's the quality like of the print?
I mean, if you're printing from your phone, I think the prints are really are good. But as ever, I think with the Instax prints through its own camera, they're very much, as again, a sort of celebration of things that are a bit blurred.
They're a bit stick it on your fridge, aren't they?
They are, yeah. Well, okay. Very well put.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's almost like when you click it back to 1950, you'll go there.
So great. So basically, it's got the decades and a little spin wheel, and you just click it onto the decade that you want. What does it do for the 90s then?
Okay, we'll do that. The text on screen is slightly upgraded, but it's also got that sort of texture on the bottom, you know, like the lines, the breakup.
Ah, that
early digital format.
Yes, I thought there was some of that in the 80s. Oh, right.
Mm. Nah, good stuff, man. Amazing.
No, fun,
amazing. Aren't
they? Yes.
They are great gadgets. Thank you for bringing those in. I'm in love with both of them. I mean, anything retro, obviously, we kind of love. Right, our Gadget Show competition is now live, but not for much longer. And you could win £5,000 to spend at CX. Yes, £5,000. And this one is just for our Patreon listeners. So you're not up against the entire internet. Your odds are actually pretty decent.
Yeah. To enter, head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow and sign up for one of our paid tiers. They start at about the price of a cup of coffee. Light, mid, or max. No, that's not the coffee. Those are the tiers.
Okay, thank you. Light gets you one entry, mid gets you three, and max gets you five. So if you fancy tipping the odds in your favour, then obviously that's the one.
Okay, so when you've done that, you just then send us a DM, direct message, within the Patreon app with your answer to the following question. When did The Gadget Show first air on TV? Was it A, 2002, B, 2004, C, 2006, or D, 2007?
And don't forget, you're not just entering the competition.
Yeah, you'll get ad-free episodes, early access, and bonus bits.
And on the max, you get the full Gadget Show archive, 20 years, nearly 500 episodes. It's all there.
Can we just check with our team via this intercom system that links to Los Angeles? Does that include every episode of The Gadget?
It does.
He's actually just stood over there. Yeah. I mean, that's great. That's absolutely mega, plus original stuff. I know, because I've filmed some of it in me lockup and, you know, my playthrough recently of Ark Raiders, and Susie's done loads of cool content as well. So, yeah, get on board.
But best of all, better odds. Loads of extras and a shot at a £5,000 tech shopping spree. But don't hang about, because entries close soon. Head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow to get involved.
Full terms and conditions are linked in this episode.
John, fantastic gadgets. Thank you for bringing those in.
Oh, pleasure.
Shall we move on to 3D TV?
Yes, I want to cast your mind back, folks, to 2010. The world had just watched Avatar, the good one.
Never seen it.
Not the shite ones I've come after. Everyone's minds were blown, and suddenly 3D, apparently, is the future, and not just at the cinema. Manufacturers looked at that new technology and the adoption of it in cinemas, and they were like, right, we can do this in your living room.
Exactly. They went massively, didn't they? Within 2 years, we're talking over 40 million 3D TVs sold in a single year. Every major brand piles in, Sony, Samsung, LG, all shouting, this is the next big thing.
Yes, and for a while it actually worked.
I'm glad that I said it was going to fail. I'm so glad.
But it did work, actually, in the case of 3D TV for a bit. You know, if you walked into any shop selling TVs, there'd be somebody there with some amazing maritime scene with fish water in 3D in your face.
In your face?
And the demo reels, of course, flying arrows coming straight past your face, exploding fruit. Don't know if anyone remembers that stuff.
Yep.
None of which you'd ever actually watch, but it was very good as demos went.
So where did it go so wrong then? Well, we're going to do a dive into that very question and take a deep dive into 3D TV and why it went so very wrong. And John, as you're with us, I want you to cast your mind back to 2010 and your very first feature looking at 3D TV, where you were very much in favour of it. Oh. Have a listen to this.
I think the viewing experience is fantastic. It's every bit as involving as 3D in the cinema. It's crisp, it's clear, the way things jump out at you from the screen is amazing. It really makes you feel part of the action.
Yes, we don't want to be negative about things. We want to give them the benefit of the doubt, I think. And it's very easy.
I think you're right. I think, as we're probably going to find out, I went big on it. And I think it is impressive. Like, it's impressive. I think as well, you think, wow, this is what it's like now. It's going to get better, and these glasses are going to become less, lighter and more wearable, the whole experience. But of course, that actually didn't necessarily happen.
I always hated it. But take us through it.
Yeah, you weren't a fan. 2010 is where 3D TV, where that boom really happened. So Avatar... can you believe it was the highest grossing film of all time at that moment in time? Mm. So it didn't just change cinema. I mean, it actually pushed a brand new entertainment category. Manufacturers saw the opportunity. They moved quickly. And they need to, don't they? Because they're constantly on the search for the next big thing. You know, that's what they've got to do to resell you the piece of hardware that you've maybe had for 3 years in your front room, and they want you to change it. So within months, the biggest names in TV, Sony, Samsung, LG, Panasonic, they all launched their 3D capable sets. And it wasn't a slow rollout either, as I remember. It was a full-scale industrial push. By 2011, global sales were already into the tens of millions, and by 2012, the category hit its peak with over 40 million 3D TVs sold in a single year. Imagine that. That's astonishing. What's interesting, of course, is that 3D TV quickly became less of a premium feature and more of just a standard add-on. If you were buying a TV, sort of mid to high end, at that time, chances are, you know, you were getting a bit of pair of glasses with it.
As with ever with televisions, I think it's very hard to think of one that particularly stood out or one particular models. But there were sort of early LED sets like the C7000 series from Samsung. That was very much a 3D adoption with the active shutter glasses. And Sony went for the HX800, HX900 series. Definitely were at that stage for Sony. They're very much in the premium area of TVs. Also PlayStation involvement there. And meanwhile, LG took a different approach with the cinema 3D line, introducing passive glasses as a cheaper, more comfortable alternative. And so there definitely was that dichotomy between the two, I think.
I had both the active ones from Sony. I remember they looked like Neo's glasses from Matrix, sort of gunmetal colour. But I also had the passive LG screen at one point, and to the extent that my glasses, my white ones, that I'm actually, am I wearing them today?
Yeah.
Yes. Then, no, I'm not sure which ones I had on my face. The guy who made them for me, Tom Davies, I don't mind saying Tom, he's a friend of mine, he made me a pair of clip-ons that worked with these. That's how much I was into it.
See, that was always the problem ones. For me, having to wear glasses.
And I remember, Phil, we did an item with wildlife cameraman Simon King, and he was very impressed by that. I was expecting him not to be impressed, but he actually was. Really quite bowled over by the quality of the 3D images.
And when we viewed the Samsung screen, Simon had a 3D epiphany.
And that looks amazing. That's bright. The 3D's good. The colours are rich. And I love the screen. The fact that it goes right to the edge and there's no great block of plastic around the edge.
Yes.
And that helps the 3D effect so much more because it's as though you're seeing the edge of the world.
Samsung's 3D TV had blown Simon's socks off and he ended the day as a card-carrying, gadget-loving 3D convert.
So, yeah, things were looking good. And it wasn't just about the TVs, though. The entire ecosystem was being built around 3D. On the content side, Hollywood leans in heavily. Major releases like Tron, Legacy, Gravity and Life of Pi are produced or converted to 3D, with Blu-ray 3D becoming the key format. Yeah, remember that?
Yeah.
And studios begin bundling 3D Blu-rays with new TVs to drive adoption. Broadcasters, like you just said, actually, Jace, also got involved. In the UK, Sky launched Sky 3D in 2010, offering live sports, films and documentaries in 3D, including Premier League football, boxing and high-profile events. See, even when I'm saying that now, I'm just thinking, why would you want to watch it in 3D? But this was me at the time. Do you remember? I was such a negative ninny about it.
But the answer is, I think, you've just answered it. Because there was so much content.
And everybody, and it was rolling, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Gaming even gets a push as well. Yeah. Sony enables stereoscopic 3D gaming on the PlayStation 3 with titles like Gran Turismo 5 and Killzone 3 supporting the format. And here's what you said about 3D gaming off the back of your trip to E3 in 2010.
Oh, cool, E3 2010.
One of the big stories for gaming in 2010 is the arrival of 3D. Not the sort of fudgy, low-resolution affair that we've been used to in the past, but proper HD, visceral, fill-your-lounge 3D. And you don't get better examples than Killzone 3.
We've heard so much about 3D over the past 12 months, but with announcements of 3D Blu-rays and Sky 3D still not capturing everyone's imagination, gaming might be the push 3D needs.
3D is here, and it's going to be big time.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, yeah, I was really excited about it.
You were getting caught up in it too.
Oh, you're not joking. I can't deny it. I remember being really excited about Microsoft Flight Simulator in 3D as well. That this sort of immersion of simulators. I loved that period in gaming was incredible, and it was part of the buzz. You know, it was a big part of the buzz.
Yeah, you were all in, weren't you?
I mean, 100%.
For a brief period between 2010, 2012, everything was aligned in terms of 3D. The hardware is selling in huge numbers. Content is being actively produced. Broadcasters are investing and manufacturers are fully committed. It genuinely looked like 3D isn't just a feature, it was the next standard for television.
Yeah, absolutely. But next is where, as is so often the case, reality bites. Because despite tens of millions of 3D TVs being sold, people weren't actually using it. By around 2012, estimates suggested fewer than 10% of owners were regularly watching content in 3D. For most people, it was something you tried once or twice, maybe to show off, you know, to the neighbours, and then you quietly kind of never switched it on again. The main issue was apparently the glasses. I mean, I was a great demonstration of their impracticality there. Specky six eyes. The glasses, apparently, most people didn't want to wear them, sat at home having their TV
funny
dinner.
That.
There were two competing systems, of course, Susie, I think you mentioned active and passive. Oh, no, John was mentioning active and passive 3D. Active shutter glasses, just to be clear, to take us back there, that was the premium option. Passive, on the other hand, led by LG, took a very different approach. They were the lightweight, kind of throwaway, almost cinema-style glasses, cheap and comfortable and no batteries required. Here's I'm going to say a younger John, but he doesn't look any different now, explaining it all.
He always looks the same, because he's a vampire.
At the moment, there are two main types, both involving glasses, active and passive.
The passive 3D system is similar to the one in 3D cinemas. It displays both the left and right image on the screen simultaneously, though this halves the resolution of the final picture.
You wear these cheap, polarizing 3D glasses, which filter the correct image through to each eye, and your brain puts it together to look 3D.
Other TVs use the active 3D system, which displays the left and right images very rapidly, one after the other, to give you full HD 3D.
These use the much more expensive active glasses that have shutters built into the lenses that open and close very, very quickly in sync with the pictures on the TV.
But frustratingly, each manufacturer uses a different method of transmitting the active signal from their 3D TV to the glasses.
Which means you can only use the 3D glasses designed for your specific make of TV.
So, straight away, consumers were facing a choice. Better quality with more hassle, or easier viewing with a noticeable drop in detail. And either way, it made watching TV more complicated than it had ever been before.
And the actual viewing experience often wasn't that great either, I do recall. I mean, the 3D only seemed to work properly if you were sitting directly in front of the screen at the right height in the right position in some cases, which meant if your whole family watching was quite awkward. And brightness and motion were issues too. I can remember having to sort of shut all the curtains doing that, which really put the family off. And the 3D images were also dimmer than standard viewing because of the way the technology worked. Actually, I remember Jason and Polly picking up on this when reviewing the latest Sony in 2012.
There's a little bit of motion blur.
Yeah, and it's not as crisp.
It's not. And the clarity between sections of the image, the depth, isn't quite as impressive. I wouldn't be inviting the neighbours around to watch that one. No. I'd sort of be quietly a little bit disappointed.
But the biggest problem, and ultimately the one that killed it, was content. At its peak, there were only a handful of dedicated 3D channels globally. In the UK, Sky 3D launched with a mix of football films and special events, but it never, ever became essential viewing. Outside of broadcast, you were relying on a relatively small catalogue of 3D Blu-rays. Big titles existed, but nowhere near enough to sustain regular use. And crucially, there was almost no everyday content. No soaps, no regular series, no reasons to switch it on night after night.
Do you know what it reminds me of?
It reminds me of tuberculosis. It comes every 30 years, 3D TV. It'll be due back in 10 years.
I was about to say, actually, strangely, Susie, I didn't expect that comparison, I'm going to be honest with you.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and the Vision Pro. And I tell you why, you're talking about content, and you're so right. It is simply about content. Content's what gets you in, and the lack of it afterwards is what gets you out. Mm. And I remember when I tried the Vision Pro, and yeah, I love the Vision Pro, and obviously I know it's ridiculously expensive, it's not for everyone. But when you go and you have it, and I would say to anyone listening and watching the podcast, if you've not tried what I'm about to say, you've got to try it. The sport on the Vision Pro, watching a basketball match, it is just incredible. I don't have one. You can do it in the Apple Store. It's incredible. And you think that, and I had the same vibe there that I had, that I clearly had looking at these clips back in 2010, around 3D. The idea is, you know what I'm talking about. You can sit courtside and watch a basketball match. The problem is, of course, you know, in order for that to become a revolution where everyone's wearing, you know, the latest version of whatever the Vision Pro becomes, if it ever becomes anything, you've got to have that massive infrastructure. So that means big cameras and courtside infrastructure and movies where they're being shot. And you can't just have Sky 3D. You've got to have BBC 3D and Netflix 3D and God knows what else. So you're so right, you know.
But if the demand was there, that wouldn't be a problem, because, I mean, it was immensely difficult with early 4K TV shooting, actually. You had to carry tons worth of drives to store it all on. And but people got over it, and they developed better ways of doing it.
They sat on their glasses and never replaced them.
But in terms of but the 3D, the demand wasn't there, really. I think that's the problem, and possibly that's still going to be the case with the Vision Pro. But that's
without a doubt. I mean, yeah. I'm comparing it both as aesthetically and also in terms of the sort of lackluster nature of it post launch.
And people just want to do what's easy. Bottom line.
Yes. I mean, easiness is a big thing.
Yeah. Don't want to be putting glasses on to watch telly. So it's bad enough putting glasses on to read anything when you get old.
Which is why, ultimately, we can now talk about its collapse. Because once people stopped using 3D, obviously, as John has just predicted, the whole ecosystem kind of fell in on itself. And it all unravelled, starting with the broadcasters.
Yeah, so by 2013, the first major exits begin. In the US, ESPN shuts down its dedicated 3D channel after just 3 years on air, citing low adoption and high production costs. Other broadcasters follow, as producing 3D content remains significantly more expensive than standard HD, with very little audience to justify it. In the UK, Sky 3D, one of the biggest pushes for the format, scales back before shutting down completely in 2015.
And at the same time, the actual industry actually managed to find something else to be enthusiastic about. And so from 2013, their focus shifted to 4K Ultra HD. So unlike 3D, it required no glasses, no change in behaviour. It delivered an immediate visible improvement in picture quality without going through a load of palaver to do it, and 4K TVs became the premium standard by 2014. And if it had a 3D capability on your TV, it was incidental. Now, after peaking at around 40 to 45 million units annually in 2012, 2013, global 3D TV sales started to fall really sharply, as really just lack of manufacturer and customer interest.
And then, of course, it's the final phase, isn't it? The withdrawal, the retreat. So LG, one of the format's biggest advocates, they ended support for 3D in 2016. Sony and Samsung followed in 2017. And no major manufacturer is producing 3D TVs for the mainstream market from 2017. No announcement, no big send-off. One of the biggest changes to the television since the advent of colour, arguably, is simply removed from new models, and it disappeared from retail outlets altogether.
You're slightly making me feel a bit sorry for it.
Yeah.
Like slightly a bit emotional. So within 7 years then, 3D TV goes from a flagship, must-have innovation, to completely obsolete. A technology that sold tens of millions of units but ultimately failed because people didn't use it. So what do we think the takeaway here is, and what do we think will be the next evolution of TV tech that may or may not take hold?
I think an important takeaway is that actually people don't want effort from watching TV. They don't have to put that amount of effort into it. I mean, it's not that 3D was bad, and actually at its best, it looked brilliant, but it just asked too much. Glasses, positioning, specific content. It turned what was an enjoyable passive experience into something active and you just don't want to do that in your living room. It crossed a line, really.
Mm. There's also that exclusion to it, isn't there? Once you've got a headset on, it's you're excluding everybody else. And especially with something like sport, you want to be inclusive. You want to be part of a gang, part of a team, part of a squad, part of a tribe.
Yeah.
You don't want to
watching sport at home, on the sofa.
You don't want to be on your own. The whole point of it is that you're sharing something. You're sharing a like-minded thing. It's all right if you're gaming, or, you know, other things you can use headsets for, but on your own. But, you know, when you want to share something, you don't want to have a headset on. You want to be like, oh, do you see that? You want to be like jumping up and down on each other and excited and sharing something. And I think that's really, really important. So now, negative, more than ever, actually.
And there's a great comparison here with the 3DS, the Nintendo 3DS. Because that did make 3D work. It was really cool. Largely because it was glasses free, of course. You could just pick it up. It was inexpensive. It was novel. It added to the novelty of the game experience. In fact, to your point, Susie, I could turn it to the left and show you it, and you'd instantly get the 3D effect. 3D TV, by contrast, as I think you've made the point for me, really. The glasses, you know, the fact you had to be in a position for a sweet spot. Not the inclusive community experience of even a little console, a 3DS. So, one example of it working, at least.
Yeah. So what's next then? Well, the industry is still chasing the idea of immersion, just in different ways. You've got OLED and micro-LED pushing picture quality to the point where it almost feels three-dimensional without needing glasses. You've got larger and thinner displays with 8K turning TVs into wall-sized experiences.
Do you think is 8K another potential? Because that seems to have been coming for a long time and it's not actually arrived. Have we reached a limit where you don't...
Well, maybe.
Need more, do you think?
When you were talking earlier, I was going to make that point. I wonder, because it does feel that this industry needs the latest bells and whistles, don't they?
Well, they need to sell products, but have we saturated? But if 3D taught us anything, it's probably this. The next big leap won't be the one that shouts the loudest. It'll be the one that seamlessly fits into how people already watch. Because in the end, the future of television isn't about adding more layers. It's about making the experience better without maybe you even noticing.
Love it. Right, that's it for this week. Another Gadget Show podcast in the bag, people. We'll be back next time with John returning. And yes, the one and only Otis Dealey joining us as well, the full squad. Now, before we go, though, there's a very important thing we have to do, which is give a big shout out to our brilliant Patreon supporters. So here we go. Get ready, folks. Huge thanks to Lincoln Brown, Jonathan Williams, Jeff Dennis, Chris Robbers, Samuel Locker, Damo MC, Nigel Harrison, QITB, Logan Gray, Chris Dennitz, Gavin Warnock, Stuart White, Paul Burks, Beano Engineer. Wow, I never knew that my favourite schoolboy magazine needed an engineer. Gareth Kirk, Colin Wharton, the Gadget Gremlin, Stuart Reinhardt, Matthew Downs, Maxwell...
Careful.
Flukiga, Adam White, Havoc, Dan Tainton, Adam Carter, Tom Sanders, Damien Deeks, Chris...
Dalrymple.
Thank you. Rick Ellison. All of you are absolute total legends.
And big love as well to Kev Barnes, Yusuf Ali, Ian Wilson, Sam Supersonic, Justin Strong, Walkerman, Barry Music Tech Info, Brian Mark Wild, Barclay Thompson, Stephen Brandom, Zamir, Andrew Brandt, Jared, Fluky D, Paul Sharrock, Mark, Colin Taylor, Alan Williams, Chris Hughes, Martin Budnarovsky. Thank you so much.
You're so good.
You should just do them every week.
You're so good at
them. And finally, massive appreciation to Peter Pinner, Dave Green, Ren Mandagorn, Dave McHugh, Matthew Riley, Chris Cool, Stephen Green, Tall Man with Glasses, Andrew Bamford, Duncan Bell, Colin Jones, Gordon Packer, Richard Martin, Simon Ryland, Darren McCracken, Philip Eddington, Anthony White, Skewy Cat, Danny Rushton, and Matt Howarth. Genuinely, we couldn't do this without you. Thank you.
No, we absolutely love you guys. Thank you so much.
If you fancy joining this fine crew, you'll get bonus episodes, behind-the-scenes bits, ad-free listening, and, of course, you'll be entered into the draw for the rather tasty £5,000 CEX prize fund.
Yeah, all you got to do is head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow, sign up and get involved.
Goodbye.
See you next time.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.